New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. We'll be exploring interspecies communication today with my guest, Dr. Davis Brimberg, a clinical psychologist, a former college professor, and a former owl handler. She is also author of the new book, Teachings from the Gatekeeper, a memoir and journey into parapsychology. Welcome again, Davis.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm very excited to be here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's always a special pleasure to have people come to Albuquerque. It's not a city that people visit as often as when I used to live in San Francisco or Las Vegas. So I am very grateful that you made the journey all the way from Seattle.
It's my pleasure to be here. Absolutely.
And, of course, you lived in New Mexico previously. I think that's one of the reasons you wanted to come back. And this is the state in which you had your experience of working not just with owls, but with a variety of wild animals.
Yes, absolutely. I lived in Santa Fe for about 4 years, and I always had a private practice, so I was working as a psychologist, but I also served as a volunteer. And when I first worked there, I immediately wanted to volunteer as a handler, but they said, no, can't do that. You have to start as a cleaner. So I started cleaning cages for 8 months. All I did was clean bird poop. And we had animals we had all sorts of birds of prey, bald eagles, golden eagles, osprey, every type of owl, different species of hawks, different species of falcons. Just everything.
Why were they there in cages?
Yes. So our center was a rescue, rehabilitation, and release center. But sometimes an animal would come in, let's say they were injured, and they could only be partly rehabilitated. So they could fly, but not well enough, or they could walk, but not fast enough to escape a predator. And so some of those animals also had a disposition that made them so that they could be handled. And those were the animals who I worked with. Those were largely the animals whose cages I cleaned. We also had animals, every type of wild animal came through our center. But in terms of the educational ones, it was largely birds, foxes, and some reptiles.
In other words, they arrived at the center because they had been injured in some way.
Yes. The goal of the center is to treat them and release them back into the New Mexican ecosystem as quickly as possible. And most of the animals were successfully released. A small portion did need to be euthanized, and another portion, though, could not be released. Mm-hmm. And those were the animals that I worked with.
I can imagine that you had a real passion for it, because here you are, a professional person, a clinical psychologist, and they're telling you to clean out the bird shit.
For 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And New Mexico, as you know, we have a full four seasons in heat, sleet, excessive temperatures, snow, ice, for 4 hours on every Friday. Mm-hmm. All I did was clean bird shit. And on the surface, all I did was clean bird shit. But really, really what I did is that I learned to act with wild animals. I learned how to behave, and I learned how to read their signals. Most of us don't have any idea of what it's like to be in a cage with a wild animal, be in a cage with a bald eagle, let's say. We don't know what that's like. We can read books about it. We can watch a lecture about it, but we don't really know until we're in there. And we don't really know what it's like to be with a bald eagle who's really not happy to see us. That is a whole different experience too. So you have to, not only do you learn to how to act when you're around them, but you learn how to read their signals better. And it was the best educational experience I could have possibly had towards becoming a handler imaginable.
Cleaning the cage.
Yes.
Because in order to clean the cage, you have to enter the cage while the animal is in the cage.
Oh, yes. Yes. You need to enter. You need to know how to handle yourself. You need to know how to react or not react when you are around the bird. You have to know all of those pieces. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those animals are not happy to see you. And you have to manage how to deal with that.
Yeah, and I would think that the risk is they might try to strike out at you immediately.
Oh, yes. In the book, I talk about this one handler who walked out. I'm sorry, she was a cleaner at this point. I saw her running out of a cage one day with blood streaming down her face. The kestrel inside had footed her, and she just had blood everywhere. Interestingly, this person would go on to become an expert handler, and something to me seems really powerful about that, that she had that experience early on.
And well, I gather you also had such experience.
Oh, I got nailed by an owl one day. So first they told us to pick a starter bird. Mm-hmm. There were certain falcons and hawks and owls who were known to be easier. And so we were only allowed to pick somebody on that starter list. And I immediately chose an owl. And each time that you work with one of the animals, you have to get certified again. So if you get certified with one owl, let's say, and you want to work with more, you have to start from the beginning. You can't just pick up.
With each individual.
That's right. You have to start with each individual bird from the beginning.
Well, because it's a question of them getting to know you.
Yes.
And you getting to know them.
Yes, exactly. So it took me a couple of years before I was able to handle the great horned. The great horned owl she was a beast. Yeah. She was a formidable creature. And one day, you have your handler glove.
So a leather glove.
It's a leather glove. And the bird is on there. And the bird has these little metal loops through their ankles. Imagine a loose belt. It doesn't hurt them at all. But then you have to attach these leather straps, which are called jesses. And then once you do that, you attach the leash. And then the bird cannot escape your glove. You give them a little lead. So if the bird is here, they have enough leeway to get here. Mm-hmm. The bird will attempt to fly, which is called a bait. So you have to give them some leeway, but they can't have too much. And if they have too little, then they can harm themselves. So I was in the process of doing the jesses, which is unfortunately near her feet. No animal likes to have their feet touched. And I guess she thought I was too slow that day, and she just nailed me. She...
In the head?
In a millisecond. She made my scalp bleed, and I was wearing a leather jacket. Mm-hmm. Any picture you see of me holding her, I always have goggles on. Mm-hmm. She had a bad reputation. Specifically, she liked to go for handler's eyes, and I was committed to keeping mine attached to my face. So I wore goggles. Mm-hmm. But she nailed me in a second. Right there.
Many people, that would have been the end. They would not have returned.
Oh, no. No. She didn't nail me that badly.
I see.
I mean, she definitely, it's having anybody suddenly draw your blood out of nowhere is shocking. Having a wild animal suddenly draw your blood it's a shocking experience. I would describe it as shocking, but not deterring. Mm-hmm. So. But yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. So you're doing the jesses. It's right by their feet. And of course, they have these long feathers. And you can't just cut the feathers. It's not like cutting hair. So it's an unfortunate position. You have to somehow quickly get those jesses in, attach the equipment, mm-hmm. without touching her feet. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It took me a couple of years to take her on.
And I imagine that even to have the owl that close to you at all takes some doing.
Yes. Well, the hardest part about working with the birds is you have to, each bird has its own hard part. In the first phase, all I would do would be in their presence. I would read to them. I would just get into their enclosures, hang out with them, and read to them.
After the cleaning of the cage?
Yes. So I was done as a cleaner, and then in my first period of becoming a handler, yeah, all I would do was sit in there and read to them. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to feel my presence. I wanted them to see me, take in whatever information they needed to, listen to my voice, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so we would be in that phase for a bit. And then in the next phase for a bit, I would get in there and I would just show them my hands. And they would just stare at me and stare at my hands. The scariest thing I could possibly bring in to that enclosure was a glove. If I brought in a glove, they knew they were going to be touched. So we would spend some time. I would crouch down and I would have them look at my hands and say, okay, she doesn't have a glove. And then eventually you put on the glove. And then eventually you get closer to them while you're wearing the glove. And then you get them to get on your glove. And then you get into the next piece. So it's all of these various steps.
Slowly.
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 Yes. And to me, it's spiritually timed, mm-hmm, right? If you're a driven person like I am, you're like, come on, let's go. But no, the animal's like, I don't know you. I don't know anybody who knows you. No, we're not doing this. And so the first part of your time with them, you're just trying to tell them that you're not there to kill them. Mm-hmm. And then as time goes by, they become more and more comfortable with you.
Right.
And then they get on your glove. And then you go into the steps of dressing them. Mm-hmm. But the hardest part, I think, is getting the animal onto your glove and then doing the dresses.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case for the great horned. Once you get her on the glove, she's great. She doesn't really bait a lot, which is where they try to fly.
Mm-hmm.
She's really good. She's settled. She's fine. The hard part is you got to get her on that glove. Other birds, they're easier to get on the glove, but then once they're actually on the glove, they bait a lot and they're much more difficult to handle. Each of them, they have their own little personalities and they have their own areas of difficulty.
Well, the great horned owl is a particularly large bird.
Yes.
Must weigh quite a bit for you to hold,
yes,
that bird up on your arm.
She weighed 3.5 pounds, which doesn't sound like a lot. But if we put 3.5 pounds here, it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would often have a crutch. Mm-hmm. If I was standing and holding her, I would have a crutch underneath my arm so that I could hold her for a long period of time.
Now, earlier I was telling you about my experience with this red-tailed hawk.
Yes, yes.
And it took no time. I mean, it was like an immediate rapport. Of course, this particular hawk was not an injured bird.
Yes.
But it had been around people quite a bit. And I was pretty naive.
Yes.
And put on the glove and held it out, and the bird hopped on. There was no jessing to my recollection or... if there was, maybe the handler did that.
Yes, it was already there. But there's a critical piece missing in your story, which is you didn't get the animal from their enclosure.
Right.
You didn't go into their territory and then pick them up and then put all the equipment on.
No.
What happened is that the most difficult part, thankfully for you in this experience, it was removed.
Yeah.
And you were dealing with somebody who was, sounds like they were very used to being handled.
Yes, and the handler was right there helping me the whole time. But I experienced, I would call it an attunement with that animal right from the start. It was like we understood each other.
It's a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
It really is. To feel that connected with a wild animal is... it's an extraordinary thing.
Mm-hmm. But I have to say, and I didn't expect the conversation would go quite like this, but your story about being nailed, as you call it. And I think you mean by their claws in your scalp.
The talons, yeah.
The talons in your scalp, but which drew blood, but in no way discouraged you.
No.
It reminds me, actually, of some of the accounts from the UFO literature of people mm-hmm. who report having been abducted, having been subjected to unpleasant types of physical examinations.
Yeah.
Some people say they should have called the FBI, or it was like people think of this as torture. Whitley Strieber, for example, the famous author of the book Communion, mm-hmm. says where he had this abduction experience in 1985, says he still has to treat the injury that mm-hmm. was given to him, but he regards it nevertheless as a kind of as a communion, as something sacred,
yes.
as a form of communication and contact that he valued in spite yes. of the discomfort.
For 1 week, all I did was say, I've got owl DNA in me. I would not shut up about it. Mm-hmm. I just kept saying it all the time. I've got owl DNA in me. Mm-hmm. This necklace that I'm wearing here it's a gold replica of a great horn's talon.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually not quite to scale. Their talons are much bigger than this.
Much bigger.
I would say considerably bigger.
It looks like it could do quite a bit of damage.
Yes.
By itself.
Yeah.
So the communication can have its rough spots. But it shouldn't be a deterrent.
To me, these are spiritual beings, mm-hmm. right? To me, I see wild animals as intermediaries between the physical plane and the spiritual world. And so to me, to be in an enclosure with a wild animal is a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And I've always seen it that way, right? To be that close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, her drawing my blood, and it wasn't a bad injury. I mean, it was an injury. She made me bleed from two places. She cut through my leather jacket as well as my scalp.
To my recollection, scalp wounds bleed a lot.
Yes. It was sizable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were in a learning period together. Apparently I was too slow, and she was done with me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the next day, I came and we went again.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly reading the wild animal. When you're with them, you are reading their signals very, very, very closely. They're reading your signals. And it is it's an experience of intuition between these two parties.
Yeah.
And she told me that day, you know, I'm done with you doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, we started up again.
And so how long did that relationship continue with this particular owl?
Oh, I worked with the owls for years.
Mm-hmm.
And my first owl, the starter bird, he was a barred owl, which is a very different species. And we went along, everything was going well. Several weeks into it, though, he suffered a seizure. He had a history of a head trauma.
Oh.
And my boss pulled me off of him and immediately assigned me to a different owl who was an Eastern Screech. And I fell madly in love with her.
Which, as you told me earlier, they warned you never to do.
Yes, which I did. I broke the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And she just, it's this incredible relationship that you develop with them. It's amazing. You know, the whole thing is bad for the ego. You fall madly in love with them and they basically tolerate you. It's like the best that you'll get.
Well, you're not part of their natural world.
No. And they're so naturally wired to fear people. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing. This is a part of what they need in order to be making a living out there in the world as a wild creature. They need to fear people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's part of the deal. You fall in love with them, and if all goes well, they tolerate you.
Mm-hmm. And you've interacted with other species besides
yes.
owls,
yes.
even besides birds.
I did different times where I raised money for wildlife organizations. I've always been very drawn to wild animals.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think they are naturally themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think as a psychologist, what I do is I help people be more of who they are. I help people really listen to themselves and really honor who they are. And this is with the wild animal models. Mm-hmm. They are naturally themselves. They're not tainted by anything. And it's a beautiful thing.
And of course, you're helping them. That's the purpose of this organization.
Yes. And you're helping to educate the public. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't really understand why we need to have wild animals, because they don't have a direct experience. But once you give somebody a direct experience, they're able to start thinking about this differently. And if we would go into schools and we would go into libraries and do all sorts of other events and educate the public on how and why these animals are important for our environment and why we need to have them, we need to protect them. I remember where I was when I was a child when I saw a hawk in a flight demonstration. A group from a wildlife center came to our school. They brought a couple of animals, and that hawk flew above my head. Mm-hmm. I remember where I sat. I remember where I felt. It was 42 years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday. It had a profound effect on me.
We had an earlier conversation about your defining moment.
Yes.
And this seems also like a defining moment for you. The person that you are now is unique because you've been an owl handler.
Yes. Yes.
That it's something that will always be with you, I presume.
What's amazing about this experience, too, is that I could have chosen any animal any animal on the starter list. Mm. And there was a huge number of them, and I just wanted the owl. Mm-hmm. And then when I was done and I was certified on that owl, I just wanted another owl. And then I was done on that owl and I wanted another owl. And I just kept wanting the owls.
If we look at the world of mythos, the world
yes.
of mythology, each animal
yes.
seems to embody certain archetypal characteristics.
Yes.
And owls, you refer to yourself as in your book as the gatekeeper.
Yes.
Teachings of the gatekeeper, which is you.
Yes.
But you describe owls as gatekeepers as well.
Yes. In spiritual writers have described them as guides through the Akashic realms, and that they are gatekeepers between this world and the next. And what was amazing is that even though I kept choosing the owls, I had never studied the mythology and symbolism of owls. This was over 10 years ago that I started to work there. And the center that I worked at was clear that we were not to discuss anything other than the scientific and environmental roles of these creatures. The center was run by a PhD in biology, and we were told point blank, this is the only category that you talk about. Mm. These creatures. And we would go to events, and if anybody asked any question that veered into non-scientific directions, they were to be directed back into the scientific and environmental roles. So it wasn't until a while into my work with the owls that I really studied more about them. And I write about this in the book. And it's their mythology and symbolism, but I look at it from an interdisciplinary perspective. I look at the work of archaeologists, sociobiologists, biologists, historians, anthropologists. And so the owl is looked at in its totality. And what scholars have found is that the animals are most associated with death, female empowerment, witches, witchcraft, wisdom, and intuition. That these are the pieces where the owl is most associated with.
The owl, as you write about it, is associated with the goddess Athena.
Yes. Yes. But the owl, in that is one person or one mythological person that the owl is very associated with. The owl is also associated with Lilith.
Lilith being the, in Jewish mythology, I recall correctly, the, was it the first wife of Adam before Eve?
Yes. She's described as the, quote, original bitch goddess. She was Adam's first wife, and she rebelled against his requiring her to be deferential to her. And she was seen as the first feminist and probably the first feminist refugee. And she fled the Garden of Eden and she would never return. Mm. And she was also seen as a witch. And this is where we get the associations of owls to witches.
Well, it's a very important figure in the Harry Potter novels.
I actually never read Harry Potter, which was another part of why I didn't know any of all of this. I was like the one person on planet Earth to have never read anything on Harry Potter.
Well, we had a lengthy conversation in our previous video, and as a matter of fact, I can link to it for viewers who haven't seen it in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. For many viewers, a link will appear in case they haven't watched our earlier interview. You talked a lot about parapsychological experiences, personal ones that you've had and in the literature.
Yes.
Do you feel that in your communication with these birds that there is a parapsychological element to it?
Yes, definitely. The degree to which I connected with these owls was very different. You know, I had spent so much time around the other animals, the eagles, the hawks, the falcons, and they were spiritual beings to me, and I loved my time with them. But when I was with those owls, something happened within me. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sleep in their enclosures with them. I wanted to just take care of them inside their enclosures with them, and I would go home and I would miss them, would think about them. And there was a very different inner experience. You know, we as psychologists are so trained to look at our feelings and to look at our own reactions. And my reactions to those birds were fundamentally different than my reactions to any other bird. And when I think about all of the different psi episodes that I've had in my life, all of the different intuitive things. Mm-hmm. My God, here I am being most connected to the most parapsychological creature on Earth. It was all in there.
Well, I think people might have something to say about dolphins, for example.
Yes.
I don't know that any creature is more psychic than any other, but I do know in the literature, for example, of parapsychology, there's some fascinating studies that suggest that when people are telepathically attuned, their brain waves start to synchronize.
Yes.
And I can well imagine that as you are paying such attention to the owl, and I presume that attention involves micro movements.
Oh, yes. Yes.
There becomes a kind of resonance between you and the non-human being that you're with.
Absolutely. Yes. There's this dance that happens between you and the bird, where they are watching you and they're constantly sensing, is this somebody I can trust? Is this somebody I'm going to be okay with? And it's an amazingly beautiful experience. I miss it tremendously. Mm-hmm. I really do.
And if I recall correctly, in your story, there was something prompted you to move very suddenly to Santa Fe, of all places, a city I don't think you'd been to, and to take up residence there. What was that about?
I had been there once very, very briefly, mm-hmm. and I wanted to live there. And then it couldn't happen for logistical reasons. And I was living in Los Angeles. And I went to Santa Fe on vacation, and within 48 hours, I decided I was going to move there. And within 6 months, I packed my car and the cat, and that was it. I was off.
So you basically gave up a professional practice in
yes.
the Los Angeles area
yes.
to relocate to a new community.
Yes. I did not know one person in the city. Nobody. I had no clients there. I had no friends there. I just felt that I needed to be there. And people thought, I mean, a lot of people thought I was nuts. My parents were really worried.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about in our previous interview, defining moments. That journey from Los Angeles yeah. to Santa Fe could be viewed as yet another defining moment in your life.
It certainly was. It was a powerful experience, absolutely. And it was a time where I listened to myself, which is really what defining moments, I think, are fundamentally about. A person listens to themselves and they honor who they are with such authenticity that in the process, they wind up defying things or defying people, right? It's a, that sort of extreme alignment with one's self, with one's sense of self. Mm-hmm. And what happened is on that trip, I thought, I have to be here. This just needs to happen. And I don't know that I could put it into words so clearly at the time, other than to say, I knew, another claircognizance, I knew with total certainty that that is where I needed to live. And so 6 months later, that's what I did.
I am guessing that your work as a psychotherapist also was enhanced because of your
yes.
Ability to develop communication with these wild creatures.
Absolutely, yes. When you're in those cages, your safety and the animal safety depends on you reading that animal quickly and accurately. You have to be able to do that immediately. And so what happens is that it forces you to become even more attuned and even more intuitive. And it absolutely helped me with my practice that I developed in Santa Fe. Yes.
Do you think in any way it helped you enhance your own parapsychological capabilities?
Yes, absolutely. I do.
How so?
There were episodes that happened in Santa Fe that were magnified. I was always intuitive, right? Even as a child, I had all of these intuitive abilities. But in the period of time that I lived in Santa Fe, it was magnified. Granted, it was also the period where my parents died. So I went through that, which would naturally magnify a person's intuition. But it was a time of which I was with the creature that I felt so attuned to in a way that I had never felt attuned to anyone or anything. And I think what happened is it magnified my psychic skills.
I recall correctly, you said when you moved to Santa Fe, you brought your cat with you.
Yes.
So you had pets.
Yes.
But pets are different than wild animals. They're not pets.
Yes, exactly.
Yet even having a pet is a form of interspecies communication.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. But it is different, right? When you work with a wild animal, there's a whole range of possibilities of what could happen. When you are in a cage with a wild animal, particularly somebody who's a great horned, who has great potential to harm you, you have to be totally attuned at a different level. And it's exciting. You don't know what's going to happen.
I once was hiking in a narrow crevasse in the desert outside of Las Vegas, and I came upon an owl.
Mm-hmm.
And it saw me probably long before I saw it, but it flew away.
Yes.
Right away. But it made, it just the sound of its wings flapping, it made quite a lot of noise. Woof, woof, woof. Like that, it really startled me.
Was it a big owl?
Yes, a big owl.
I think you saw a great horned.
Probably. And it was an awesome experience. And, you know, I was maybe 10 feet away from it.
Yeah. They're extraordinary, extraordinary creatures. Mm-hmm. Well, their entire bodies are built for listening. So more than likely, that owl saw you, heard you quite a bit before you got to that, before you got that close to them. Their entire bodies are built for listening in the sense that their faces are like little satellite dishes and their ears are asymmetrical, which helps them to triangulate sound. They can hear animals scurrying beneath the soil many feet away. They can hear animals scurrying beneath snow many feet away.
So they have sensory capabilities beyond that of a human.
Definitely. They have excellent hearing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what their the strongest sense is, their hearing. They have good eyesight, but not at the level of their hearing. Mm-hmm. So if I was an owl, right? I can see you perfectly with my peripheral vision, but if I was an owl, I would need to do this, right? Their necks go 270 degrees. Not quite the Exorcist girl, but pretty close.
Yeah. It's very interesting how owls can do that.
Well, they don't really, they can't do this. That whole movement that happens with our eyes, they can't do. And they don't have good peripheral vision. But clearly seeing straight on, yes.
Now, we touched earlier on the whole question of aliens, UFOs, and alien communication, which I think is yet another form of interspecies communication. But I think there's a relationship. When we learn how to communicate with the many different species, millions of different species on this planet, it would seem to me we would be better able to communicate with these visitors that, as Whitley Strieber calls them, who, is, to the best of my understanding, are visiting us.
Yes. Yes. Well, my sense is that the wild animals will feel those creatures coming long before we will.
And also, it seems to me that if I were a visitor myself, I would pay attention to how the top species on the planet, the humans, are treating the other species and the environment.
Yes.
That would say a lot about humans.
Absolutely, yes.
How do you feel about that?
I think we greatly need more empathy in this world. If there was something that's missing, I would say it's that. I think if those beings that you described from the UFOs saw how we treated each other and saw how we treated animals, my guess is they would probably feel that we needed more empathy.
I'm sure they do see that. It's not as if it's hidden. At the same time, you were doing very compassionate work and with people who were also doing very compassionate work.
It's absolutely,
you know, the human race is something of a mixed bag in that regard. And I'm guessing that animals may have a sense themselves of different people.
There are sometimes there is a wonderful person that an animal just doesn't want to work with, and it just doesn't quite work out. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I did not have that experience. But some of them are easier. I mean, the great horned owl was not on the starter list, I can tell you that.
But you were drawn to that owl, I assume.
Oh, yes. I was drawn to all of them.
Do you give them names?
Yes. So in the book is a book of nonfiction, of course. Mm. And so I've changed everybody's names. So the owls, even their names got changed.
Well, Davis Brimberg, what a joy to be with you, to share your passion for these wild creatures.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today. It's been wonderful.
It's been a joy for me as well.
Thank you.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Thank you. 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.